From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, anemic state funding and fewer people in the classroom, challenging times for Michigan's public universities.
There are 15 public universities in the state. Only four have had even a 1% increase in enrollment over the past decade.
John U. Bacon on the great Halifax explosion of 1917.
904.35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone.
And we look at direct primary health care.
People need to know that this is not insurance, right? This is a direct payment between a consumer and a primary care physician.
So you pay a set monthly fee, but then you kind of get essentially almost unlimited access to your primary care physician. So you can text us, call us, video chat.
Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Due to live coverage of today's impeachment hearings, we are revisiting some of our past stateside conversations, including the conversation exploring direct primary care and how it could change the way many of us visit the doctor. But first, the new budget Governor Whitmer signed gives Michigan's public universities $1.47 billion for the new fiscal year. Now, take that and adjust it for inflation, and here's the deal. Public university funding from the state is dropping. Bridge Magazine's Ron French reports this is just one more problem that some Michigan public universities are wrestling with, along with shrinking enrollment. Ron French, you say this is a perfect storm for Michigan universities. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me here. Well, first of all, there are fewer high school graduates. Our birth rate in Michigan is the lowest it's been in since 1944. So there are fewer students that are graduating from high school looking to go to college. And also the college-going rate is down even among those students because the economy is good and people can find jobs. And I think, do we really want to go to college for 4 years or just go out and work with my dad? You combine that with the fact that state support for public universities is, when you take inflation into account, lower. And some of these universities are really in a pickle.
So give us an idea of which of Michigan's public universities is feeling this pressure and which are not.
There are 15 public universities in the state. Only four have had even a 1% increase in enrollment over the past decade. Six of them have had double-digit decreases. Central Michigan, one of the biggest universities in the state, their enrollment is down 21% in a decade. Eastern Michigan, 18%. Saginaw Valley, 18%. Northern Michigan, 19%. Lake Superior State, down 14%. So it's really hitting some of our biggest name universities really hard.
Now, I know from your piece, University of Michigan, Michigan State, U of M, Dearborn, they're kind of exempt from this. They're doing okay as far as increasing the headcount and increasing.
Right. The flagships universities are doing fine. But everyone knows them, and so they got the big sports teams. And so when these students have a choice, and they have more choices now than they did. They end up going to one of those two universities.
But golly gee, when you think of all this long list of institutions with enrollment down, it still costs the same to run those institutions, doesn't it?
Yeah. If you have three fewer English majors, you can't get rid of an English professor, and you still have to have the lights on in the English department. So really, the base costs. It's hard to decrease those costs at the same rate that you're losing enrollment.
So what's the answer?
And so the answer has to be they raise tuition.
And then you have fewer people saying, I want to go.
Exactly. And the higher the price are, the more people say, I think I'll just go straight into the workforce.
What you describe, Ron, sounds like a dog chasing its tail.
I know. It's very tough. And this isn't just a Michigan problem. Mm-hmm. It's happening nationally, both because of lower birth rates. And also because, and it seems odd to say this, but because the economy is doing well, when the economy does well, university enrollment usually goes down. Mm. And so because people think they can make a living without accruing this kind of debt.
Yes. The other thing that I thought was interesting as I looked at your piece in Bridge, Ron, was there is kind of a political tinge where there's this belief among some that universities are liberal bastions that are hostile to conservative thought, and that's actually keeping some students away?
Right. If you look at polling, you'll find that the attitudes, there are greater negative attitudes about universities in rural areas. And oddly enough, that is where you actually need more people to attend college to turn the economy around. But yeah, what happens is the attitudes for between Republicans and Democrats about higher education were the same until 2016. What happened that year? Well, what now you see a complete split in that, and there's a large majority of Republicans in polling who do not see universities as a positive in American society.
So what are the implications for the state of having fewer Michiganders in college?
Well, that's the thing. We have leaders in the state who rightly are saying we have to increase the number of adults with some sort of post-high school degree or certificate.
Just point at what happened with the Amazon headquarter bids.
That's the perfect example. Yeah. They didn't come here. We didn't make the cut to be a finalist because we didn't have enough talent. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have trouble attracting businesses. And when people get degrees, they often leave the state. So we're 31st in the country in the percentage of adults with a high school degree, and unshockingly, we're 33rd in median income. So when you look at those numbers, you say you need more people with college degrees. Well, but we're not doing that, and the result of that is going to be that we're going to have a trouble turning around our economy.
So. Is anyone talking about solutions to this perfect storm for these schools that are seeing the declining enrollment?
A lot of the solutions that you hear have to do, frankly, with more investment. And I know that people then often like turn off the radio when they hear that. But the fact is, we're 44th in the nation in per capita investment in higher education. Even if you don't want to give more money to the universities, the state could increase the amount of financial aid for students going to college. That way you're not giving to these universities that you think are fat, but you're saying, here's additional scholarship money for good kids who want to go to school and want to get an education. Right now, they're not doing that. Some of these universities are likely going to have to adjust to being smaller than they've been. Mm-hmm. Central Michigan was 26,000 kids. They're at 21 now. They may have to adjust to being that size in the future. The demographics are not going to turn around in the near future.
Ron French, you will find his piece on this perfect storm Michigan universities are facing by going to bridgemi.com. It's always great to talk with you, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Deer Camp, a memoir of a father, a family, and the land that healed them. It's the latest book by Michigan native Dean Kuypers. Stateside's book critic Keith Taylor has this review of Kuypers' memoir about his childhood spent with his father and brothers in rural West Michigan.
Tolstoy famously wrote that all happy families are like one another. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. The last part of that sentence certainly seems to apply to the West Michigan family Dean Kuypers describes in his new memoir, The Deer Camp. The family is not poverty-stricken. Kuypers' father clearly did well enough financially, and even though he was never generous, the financial difficulties the sons face feel almost chosen. The father has a superficial piety that keeps him away from substance abuse, but seems to allow him infidelities and the psychological, even physical abuse of his children. The distance he creates between himself and his sons seems almost insurmountable. But the happiness, even the joy, that rises out of this book also seems unique. Even in the first half, when their lives seem impossible and almost beyond redemption, Dean Kuypers and his brothers find their own slightly oblique ways to support each other through substance abuse, mental illness, and their inabilities, much like their father's, to form lasting relationships. After all their fights and problems, these four men recognize they have a commitment to each other when they realize they have a similar commitment to a small plot of land many miles north of their homes in Kalamazoo, up closer to Ludington, on the southern edge of the Manistee National Forest. It is there, at the deer camp, where the book finds its heart. It is there that the relationship between the three brothers and their father can begin to heal. The small hunting retreat they buy is 95 acres of scrubby third-growth forest. The land has been over-farmed and abused by chemicals. Large stands of non-native trees have taken root where nothing else will. It is a sandy, windswept place surrounded by swamps and filled with mosquitoes. It is the kind of place anyone who has driven back roads in north-central Michigan will recognize in a minute. It is a landscape that many of us, against all reason, have come to love. As Dean and his brothers find ways to reinvigorate the land, the game species they want to hunt, the woodcock, the ruffed grouse, even the white-tailed deer, come back, healthy and plentiful. And that isn't all. As Kuipers writes, a new affection flowed out of the sand and trees and grew thick among us. As important and as moving as the family saga is, the author isn't content with leaving it focused simply on them. Throughout the book, he searches for larger answers to the problems that split this family and to the place that seems to have healed them. Near the end, he quotes a Native American educator who points out that the Okanagan word for the human body and its senses translates as land dreaming capacity. I read this, Kuipers writes, and cheered, and it stayed with me forever. She didn't mean dreaming like a story that is born in your mind and seems isolated to your private thoughts. She meant the kind of dream that interprets information flowing in from elsewhere. In this lovely memoir, it is information from a restored piece of land that goes a long way to healing the relationship between a father and his sons.
That was writer Keith Taylor with his review of Dean Kuiper's latest book, his memoir, The Deer Camp. Coming up, a century ago, the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb destroyed half of Halifax, Nova Scotia, killing and injuring thousands. And then people stepped up to help.
It is true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby.
After the break, my conversation with John Eubacon. We will revisit that about his book, The Great Halifax Explosion. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Due to live coverage of today's impeachment hearings, we are revisiting some of our past Stateside conversations. A beautiful white spruce tree arrived today at Boston Common, a gift from the people of Nova Scotia. And if you want to know why Nova Scotia spends $180,000 each year to send its finest Christmas tree to Boston, the answer goes back 102 years. That's when two ships collided in Halifax Harbor. The resulting explosion is known as the Halifax Explosion, and it's one of the greatest maritime disasters in history. Some 2,000 people were killed and many thousands were injured. That Christmas tree is Nova Scotia's thank you each year for Boston's compassionate response to this disaster, a thank you that continues to this day. John Eubacon tells the story in his book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. I spoke with him in 2017 when the book was first published. What turned your attention to this?
Two things. The two sides of my family, the Bacons, were in New York throughout the whole process, the last 200 years. The other side, the Canadian side, went north to New Brunswick. My grandfather was 12 years old in 1917 when this happened. I used to spend my summers in New Brunswick talking to him. He kept on telling me about this, you know, two-ton anchor that went 2 miles this way, another part that went 3 miles that way. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't think he was crazy, but I never heard of it anywhere else until 1999, when I'm researching my first book on the history of University of Michigan hockey. It turns out Michigan's first hockey coach happens to have been a first responder, if you will, to the Halifax explosion. And that's what inspired him to become a doctor, go to U of M, and start Michigan's hockey program.
So you started digging and digging.
I did, and I got lucky and lucky because it turns out his papers, his letters, Joseph Barsh was a great letter writer, and his grandchildren, who are here in the state, and I know them, they've got his letters from World War I, where he served for a year and ended up getting hit with a shell and handicapped for a little while and overcame that. His letters from Halifax and his letters from the University of Michigan, and I just got really, really lucky.
All right, talk about this explosion, December 6th, 1917, in Halifax Harbor. When you think about how big was it? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, this always stuns people that they had 6 million pounds of TNT and other high explosives on this ship. That's a bad idea. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty on one ship. So you should not do that in the first place, but they were desperate. It's 1917. The Russians have left the war, so now the Eastern Front has been conceded to the Germans, and they're paranoid of the Germans rolling over the British, the French, and now the Americans who just joined the war. So you're overdoing this. Then, of course, you bump into another ship in Halifax Harbor. That's a bad idea. A fire starts. The crew takes off for the other shore, so no one is warned. And this ghost ship, now burning, slides perfectly into Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:46 a.m. So people are walking to work, they're walking to school, the school children take a detour and go to watch this thing. Thousands are watching the ship burn, and at 9:04:35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone. 25,000 are homeless, about half the city, 9,000 are wounded, 2,000 are dead in a split second. It was 1/5 the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And we know that because Oppenheimer, who's the master behind the atomic bomb, he studied this at a conference at Cal Berkeley in 1942. It's the only other comparison they had for the A-bomb. So that's how serious this was. That's the horrible news. And the great news happens afterwards.
Indeed. Getting back to where we were historically, as you say, World War I had been going on for more than 3 years. The U.S. had entered the fight that spring of 1917. How key was Halifax to the war effort?
Halifax was the conduit for almost everything from North America going to the Great War. That includes Americans and Canadian soldiers, almost all materials, food, supplies, munitions, relief supplies, you name it. Almost any British soldier not already in Britain was going to go through Halifax, as well as the Americans. So that was a crucial, arguably the most crucial port during World War I.
And history happens when you get two entities winding up in the same place at the same time, that one in a million thing. In this case, two ships, the SS Mont Blanc and the SS Emo. Now, tell us about them and why they were in Halifax Harbor that fateful morning.
Mont Blanc was going to Bordeaux, France, to turn that 6 million pounds of explosives into shells to bomb Germans.
And basically, as you say, loaded beyond the gills with incredible explosives to the point where the captain said, nobody can light a cigarette.
No one can even hold a match in your pocket. That's how terrified they were. They lined the hull with plywood to make sure there's no metal-on-metal contact, because they knew that one spark could send them up. They secured the holds with copper nails because copper is one of the few metals that does not spark when struck. They feared that one spark, one rub, could send them all up. They lined their shoes, their boots, with canvas covers to make sure they didn't spark. So these guys in the ship knew that this was a floating time bomb, basically.
So they were pulling into Halifax Harbor?
They were pulling into Halifax Harbor, and they think after 4 days by themselves, no convoy, from New York, Brooklyn, New York, to Halifax, they think, okay, finally we're safe. Relax. And they went through not one, but two metal gates underwater, which kept the U-boats, the German submarines, out of the harbor. So you're finally in. You're dying to get in here. It's 8:45 in the morning. The Emo, the Norwegian relief ship, was already a day late because of the same fences. The fences kept them from getting out the night before. So they're in a rush to go out. That captain is a hothead, which we make clear in this thing. So he's a problem, and he does not have any idea what Mont Blanc has on it.
Why is that? You'd think there would be warning flags.
One warning flag means the German U-boats just outside Halifax Harbor have you as a sitting duck. So about five guys in the whole harbor had any idea what was on the ship.
Okay. So
there's your problem.
There's your problem, because it really is a Murphy's Law.
One thing after the other. And safeguards, some of them stupidly, the protocols were removed because, you know, they're in a haste. It's World War I. Guys are dying overseas, left and right. So the British Crown did not care that much what's happening in Halifax. They're worried about their guys getting mowed over in the trenches of Europe.
Isn't this a big harbor? How did these two wind up bumping up?
It's a big harbor, except for one part called the Narrows, which are in fact narrow. It's all of a sudden only 1,000 feet across for about a mile, 18-mile long harbor. It's the second biggest natural harbor to Sydney, Australia. It's a great harbor. But now you've got two ships trying to get out, get past each other in this 1,000-foot wide Narrows, and the one ship, the Imo, keeps on ignoring the rules and going to the left and to the left and to the left of each successive ship. This is the same as driving a car on a two-lane road. You want to pass on the left, you better know what you're doing because there'll be a car coming by on the right. That car, in this case, was Mont Blanc.
Oh, boy. So they bump.
They bump. It's a game of chicken, and finally at the last second, Mont Blanc says this guy's crazy and he's not going to get on the correct side. So they try to peel off the last second, as we would on the highways, and try to peel off left. So does the Imo at the last second. So they bump, and it's not a big bump, but it's a big enough bump to knock over the airplane fuel on top. They had unwittingly constructed the perfect bomb with the fuse on top and the heavy explosives down below.
So it starts to burn. And the crew of the Mont Blanc, as you say, they knew what was going on. They got off that ship and paddled to safety, didn't they?
They had two rowboats, 20 people each, and they went the other direction to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, across the Narrows.
And so here's this ghost ship.
This ghost ship now, which no one knows what's on it.
And the whole town's like, there's a ship burning. I can just see
burning.
This. Let's go see.
It's exciting. And the war seems so far away, they don't imagine what's on it. So that's, and the timing is cruel, like I said, because everyone's going to work and to school. The stoves from breakfast are still burning in every home in Halifax, which is going to matter.
And the kind of explosion, I mean, you take us to that moment. Give us a for instance. You have so many victims of this explosion. What story really hit you hard?
As far as the power of it, my grandfather's story on the 2,000-pound anchor being flown 2 miles, that got my attention. Windows were blown out 50 miles away. And again, the whole town is just flattened. If you were standing within a quarter mile of it, you were flown a quarter mile up the hill, and you had no idea what just happened to you. But all of a sudden, you're at a new park, Needham Park, on the top of the hill of Halifax. So you're watching it 1 second. Next second, you've got black grime all over you. You're wet from the tidal wave that happens afterwards, a 35-foot tidal wave, which drowned those who survived, the first thing. And no one can believe what's happening. And the look of bewilderment was repeated often by people. No one was screaming or yelling. They're walking around like zombies. Like, what has just happened?
And people vanished, didn't they? Some of them, never to be found, no
trace.
There
are about 600 people we have no idea what happened to.
What kind of injuries, John, were most common?
Sad to say, facial wounds, because the town, it's like a miniature San Francisco. They got these beautiful homes, two-story homes, with bay windows, because the bay is beautiful, so they've all faced the bay. Everyone went to the bay windows and their workshops and so on to watch the Mont Blanc burn. Back then, there's no safety glass. This is the thin-paned stuff. So when they're watching, the facial wounds occur. About 300 or 400 were blinded during this process. And my great aunt, Aunt Ruth, lived in Halifax for a while. And you were taught when you grew up in Halifax in the 20s and 30s, if you see somebody with one of these blue-tinged facial scars, that's from the TNT itself, you are told to not stare because that's the explosion. So this went on for decades.
There was, amidst all of this disaster, you bring us some very special moments of human kindness, including a barbershop story.
And what's great about this is, obviously, a disaster you're never going to forget, but they remember the human kindness as much as anything else. And one beautiful little example among many in this book, Noble and Gordon Driscoll, 10 and 12 at the time, they go about an hour away for a haircut, because that's what we have to go for a haircut. That's where they're recovering. Mom gives them $1 to go in for a haircut. This is a week after the disaster. Okay. They still have glass shards, little bits of glass and wood in the back of their heads. So the barbers are cutting their hair and trying to get the oil out of their hair, which is very stubborn. And when the kid winces, when Noble winces, the barber says, ah, you must be from Halifax. He knows immediately. He goes over to the other barber and they whisper to each other, unbeknownst to the two kids. They go back and tell all the other customers, we're not open today, got to go away. They give the kids two shampoos to make sure they get the oil out. They pull out all the little glass shards and wooden chips. And afterwards, Noble's getting very nervous because all he has is a dollar. And that will not pay for two shampoos and all the extra attention. He gives the barber a dollar, feeling embarrassed and a bit sheepish. And the barber waves it off and smiles. And with the other barber, they go across the street to a clothing store and buy the kids a new wardrobe because all their clothes are gone, except for what they're wearing. So, and 80 years later, what we remember is the barber. 100 years later now, that barber whose name I don't know, but that act of kindness lives on forever. And I think that's really, really cool.
I'm speaking with John Eubacon about his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And let's talk about that heroism, just like we saw after 9/11 when people and nations really came together, put aside differences to stand as one against a tragedy. There really was a coming together after the Halifax explosion, wasn't there?
No question. And it's true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby. It is soldiers going into burning homes to get cats out, for crying out loud. It's again and again and again. The extraordinary heroism came from ordinary people. And we saw a lot of this during 9/11. This is on actually a grander scale, because those are two towers that the firemen go up and that's about it. This is all over town. This goes on for about a day and a half, this endless burning. So a 14-year-old girl is one of our heroes. Joseph Barge, we'll get to, is one of our heroes as well. And it's really inspiring. So those of you who are tired of disasters, it's about a quarter of it is set up. Middle third or so is the explosion. And then the last, whatever that leaves, my math is off. almost a third or so, more than a third, is how the city and the people responded, including the Americans.
Yes, because there were testy relations, as you point out. We get a good history lesson into the formation of Canada, and things were a little testy, but particularly the city of Boston stepped up.
Really quite amazing. And look, I grew up with more Canadian history than most, given my mom being a Canadian native. I had no idea that we were not allies at all in 1917. In 1776, when the start of the war, that side of my family, including 60,000 other American colonists, went to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The American side of me calls them the scaredy cats.
Yeah.
The Canadian side is the United Empire Loyalists.
That's right.
So they basically founded New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, essentially. So they had no great feelings towards the U.S. In 1812, it's the Canadians versus the Americans, essentially, as well as the British, of course. The guy tried to burn down the presidential mansion, and he failed. He tried to burn it down, but it's made of white stucco, so you can't get very far with it. But it blackened it, and that forced them to whitewash it, which is why it's called the White House. That guy is buried with honor in the center of Halifax. So, and then you got Joseph Barge, the world's greatest privateer at the time in Canada. He sunk, captured, or burned more than 60 American ships, the most wanted man in America. And he was finally caught in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where they walked him up and down Main Street and fed him hardtack for 2 months.
A perp walk.
A perp walk, yeah. The world's first perp walk, probably, I suppose. So we were not allies, even in the Civil War. Half of Halifax supported the Confederates, and with great danger they did so, because they wanted the cotton. In 1911, I can't believe this either, the Speaker of the House of the United States, the Paul Ryan of his day, got on the floor of U.S. Congress to vociferously advocate for the annexation of Canada, and he received cheers and a glowing report from the Washington Post. 1911, American leaders were talking about annexing Canada. So we are not allies.
But Boston stepped up to a point where it's even recognized today.
It is recognized today in no small terms. Boston, they're still shipping towns. And even though they're at war for basically 100 years, when it happened, the Massachusetts governor, Samuel McCall, without even being asked, they send two trains, two ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, all the supplies you could ever imagine, to run a couple of hospitals for a few weeks at about $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million today, without being asked. And you talk to any of the survivors in the 70s or 80s, late in their life, the first thing they always mentioned was the help from Boston. And it turned, by the way, U.S. and Canada into allies. That's where it starts. The Halifax is so appreciative. To this day, they spend $180,000 to find their best spruce tree in the entire province, 50 feet high or so. Usually a private citizen. They've got a cutting ceremony. They load it on a truck. They send it 600 miles down to Boston. They raise it in Boston Common for the holidays. They light it in a big ceremony. It costs them $180,000, and no Bostonians, or very few, have any idea why they're being thanked. But as a Haligonian, as they're called, said, they said, why should we stop thanking them? Which to me is such a great spirit and so counter to what we see internationally right now.
Indeed.
This is how people are supposed to get along.
And other things too. Medicine? There were medical advances made because of what was encountered in the aftermath?
Ophthalmology, eye surgery was greatly advanced because you had all these doctors in town who spread best practices. And as I said, there are hundreds of blinded people from Halifax. Pediatric surgery. A guy named Dr. Ladd from Boston came up and he realized during the burn victims, the kid burn victims in Halifax, that you have to approach this differently than you do adult burn victims for various reasons. He goes back to Boston, has a 2-bed clinic, and from that he gets a whole wing. Talk to any pediatric surgeon, and they'll tell you the father of pediatric surgery is Dr. Ladd, and he learned it in Halifax.
And then, astoundingly, the Great Halifax Explosion, as you say, has a direct connection to men's hockey at the University of Michigan.
This is my favorite of the stories, as you might imagine.
I can guess. But, yeah, all things do come down to University of Michigan.
Of course
athletics.
They do. Why shouldn't they? But that privateer I mentioned, yes, who sunk 60 and burned and captured 60 American ships, his great-grandson also grew up not liking Americans too much. He fought in World War I. He's all gung-ho about it. He got hit with a shell, came back to learn how to walk again in Halifax when the boat blew up. And he knows first aid. So by the end of the weekend, he is basically performing surgeries he has no business performing, but it's all hands on deck, 9,000 wounded.
Because he'd been on the battlefield in World
exactly.
War I.
Exactly. And so, you got 9,000 wounded, so what can you do?
Yeah.
That's when he realizes, I don't want to be a businessman in Montreal, which he was, making good money. I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to be a pastor like my father. I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people, not kill them. And his uncle gives them $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan. And I'm not quite sure why. His cousin was there in surgery, so perhaps that was it. He comes to Ann Arbor. He marries a woman from Battle Creek, an American. He becomes an American citizen because the Bostonians so impressed him. He said, I've changed my view forever about Americans based on Boston. Becomes a citizen, goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the athletic director at the time, and says, you need a hockey program. He said, only if you're the first coach. So while a med school student, while married, he starts the hockey program. It has now won 9 national titles, which is a national record. It starts with the Halifax Explosion.
This is an extraordinary book, John Eubakin's book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. You put a lot of work, a lot of time into telling this story, and I can tell it has really grabbed you and moved you.
It has. And even writing it, I got choked up a few times. People have already read it, and the early going, you included, have gotten choked up a few times. It's a story about disaster, but how people respond to the disaster. And these people ended up living very good lives. That's incredible. They lost, you know, 5 siblings, and it's horrible, obviously. And they find ways to pick themselves up. And people who have interviewed them say they have such great perspective. They are so patient. This is before they passed away, obviously, in the 70s and 80s. And they're so good-hearted. And that's the lesson of this whole thing, is that no matter what happens to you in this world, somehow they have found a way to live good, productive, contributing lives.
A lesson for the ages. John Eubakin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what is direct primary care, and how could it change the way many of us visit the doctor? We'll talk about that after the break here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There was a time in this country when someone who needed medical care would take themselves to the doctor's office, or the doctor might make a house call. Care was provided, the doctor was paid, and everything that transpired was between patient and physician. No insurance companies, no co-pays, no filing claims. Well, some physicians are turning back the clock, so to speak, offering direct primary care, subscription-based. In Grand Rapids, Dr. Matt Falkowitz and Nicholas Blank are doing that through their Nova Direct Primary Care. So let's talk about direct primary care as we say hello to Dr. Matt Falkowitz. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
So, doctor, what are the basic differences between direct primary care and that traditional primary care that most people are used to?
Probably the biggest difference upfront is that we don't bill any insurance. One of the big hallmarks of direct primary care is a membership-based model. So you pay a set monthly fee, but then you kind of get essentially almost unlimited access to your primary care physician. So you can text us, call us, video chat, home visits, you know, in-office visits, all of that is included in that membership, and you don't have to pay a specific copay each time you see us.
And then if certain tests are ordered or x-rays or treatments, that would be something that you would pay for on top?
Yeah. So most direct primary care practices have other resources around their office that they can offer x-ray, they can offer lab work, those sort of things we get at decreased rates because people are paying cash for it. You know, going through insurance and in those other sort of avenues, prices tend to get inflated. So just to give you an example, if you need to check what we call a basic metabolic profile, which checks things like sodium, potassium, your kidney function, those sort of things. If you go through a hospital system or an insurance-based system, that can easily cost you $40 to $100 on an outpatient basis, but through us, it's $2.50. So those excessive kind of costs are really what we're trying to avoid with direct primary care.
And just give us an idea what it costs for that monthly fee, that subscription.
So our subscription is, we do it age-based. So for the pediatric population or age 0 to 17, we do $29 a month. For 18 to 49, we do $59 a month. And then for 50 and over, we do $79 a month. if you sign up as a couple or as a family, we do end up offering a discount with that as well.
What made you and your partner, Dr. Blank, decide that direct primary care was the best way for you to serve patients?
How much time do we have? A few things. So Nick and I actually trained together in residency, and we initially started kind of wanting to do an insurance-based practice. And then once we kind of came across electronic health record that was built specifically for direct primary care practices, we kind of went down that avenue. But really the biggest difference we see is that we can spend more time with patients, and we are very patient-centered when it comes to our primary care, and we just want to sit down and get to know you. So when we were working in residency, and even after residency, working in a rural community in an insurance-based system, we're often running 20, 30 minutes behind. The biggest reason for that is we just want to sit and get to know you, get to know your story, and try to talk about all the different concerns that you may have. In insurance-based practice, it doesn't really work out very well because you only get, 15 to 20 minutes per visit. Direct primary care, we're able to sit, spend an hour with you, get to know you a lot better, talk about all the concerns that you have, talk about all the things that we may want to address with you, and we have enough time to get those things done.
You know, as you mentioned, that timetable that a doctor in an insurance-based practice gets a certain set period of time to spend with the patient, and then you should move on. What does the public not understand, doctor, about what it's like to practice medicine in that kind of insurance-based model?
There's a lot of checkboxes that we have to click in each visit. There's a lot of studies out there as far as how much time doctors are spending really on the administrative tasks, pleasing insurance companies, those sort of metrics that we're doing that may not be related directly to patient care. And it's roughly about 2/3 of our time. So if you have a 20-minute time slot, that also accounts for the time that, the nurse checks you in, they're doing all your vitals, they're taking your history, doing that sort of thing. By the time we get into the room, it may already be 7 to 10 minutes into your visit. So really at that point, we may only have 10 minutes to see you. If you have two specific concerns on top of what you came in to be seen for, say high blood pressure, diabetes, something like that, it becomes very difficult to try to address each problem in a 2-minute time span. And then we're sitting here trying to fill out, your history, trying to type in a physical exam, trying to come up with a plan and type everything in the computer. Oftentimes we're facing away from the patient. You feel like it's a very impersonal space when really it should be a very personal space, the relationship with you and your doctor.
What kind of patients does direct primary care work best for, and what does the model not work well for?
I talk with Nick about this all the time. There's probably four subsets of patients that work really well in the direct primary care system, at least for our practice specifically. One is patients who are uninsured. That can be for any number of reasons, whether they're self-employed or they make a little too much for Medicaid but can't afford the marketplace. People who have cost-sharing ministries or health-sharing ministries. People who have high deductible plans, so anything over $2,000. And then also people who aren't happy with their current healthcare experience. We're something new or something different, and we can offer you the access. If you are really happy with your current situation, you're happy with the doctor you have, you're happy with the insurance you have, there's probably going to be no reason for you to switch to us just because we're not going to be able to beat that. There's not a huge population, I would say, that wouldn't fit well with the direct primary care system. But if you're happy with what you have, chances are we're not going to be able to make that any better.
Data showing that the number of DPC practices and doctors considering opening a DPC practice is going up. Do you think direct primary care could or should overtake insurance-based treatment?
So it is growing quite rapidly. So I would say, a couple years ago, there were maybe only 400 to 500 practices nationwide. And as of July 2019, there were over 1,200, with a rate of growing maybe 1 to 2 every week at this point. That's more of a symptom of the system. Doctors are getting, burned out. There's a lot of moral injury happening within the system. So people are trying to get out and try to provide better care and have more control over their health care. Do I think direct primary care should take over the entire insurance system? I wouldn't phrase it like that, just because I think some sort of insurance is still necessary. As a DPC physician and being a family medicine doctor, I can't handle things that are emergencies like heart attacks. I can't provide surgical services if you need your gallbladder or appendix out. So you're always going to need some sort of coverage, whether it's a catastrophic coverage, a high deductible plan, or a health sharing ministry, like I mentioned before. But I think from a primary care standpoint, primary care is very well known to decrease costs in the health system overall. So the more primary care doctors we have out there that are able to spend more time with patients, do things very efficiently and effectively, I think we can decrease costs significantly and help the population in general.
How does direct primary care compare to clinics? For example, that you could do a walk-in and pay a small fee. People who don't have insurance may turn to that kind of maybe a walk-in clinic.
The biggest difference, I think, with direct primary care and kind of an urgent care or a med center or you know, a walk-in clinic would be really the relationship with your doctor. So if you go to an urgent care or walk-in clinic, you're going to be seeing someone different every time that has a very, very brief amount of time to try to get to know you, review your chart, and just see what the chief complaint is. You know, from a primary care office perspective versus an urgent care or walk-in clinic, you're much more likely to get something like an antibiotic for a common cold or something like that, rather than if you had a trusting physician relationship with a direct primary care practice. I think one of the biggest fears in the healthcare system is really cost. You know, so if you go into an urgent care clinic, you may pay a $75, $50 copay. You want something done at that visit just because you don't want to have to pay to go back. In the direct primary care practice, you know, if you're paying the set monthly fee, you can see us as often as you need without fear of cost, without fear of paying another time for the second visit, even if it's only 3 to 4 days later. So that's really the biggest difference. You have that personal relationship and you know who you're going to talk to every single time.
Dr. Falkowitz, do you think concerns that DPC practices will create more healthcare inequality? Is there validity to that concern? You know, there are those who can afford it and those who can't.
So direct primary care, we try to do our best to keep the prices as affordable as possible. Now, if we think about, you know, $50 a month is half the cost of a phone bill, or, you know, if you get coffee every single day, if you cut your coffee so every other day at Starbucks or Big B, you can afford our membership. I don't think it necessarily will create inequality. I think moving forward, if we push direct primary care, you know, try to find, you know, innovative ways to get our name out there as far as, you know, other payers and things, maybe even considering paying for the membership just because we decrease costs overall. So from an inequality standpoint, you know, most of our patients are uninsured. Most of our patients, about 90% of our patients, are either uninsured or have a high deductible health plan. So those are, you know, tend to be the population that we're looking at as far as being with the inequalities.
What do you think the answer is? I know you're in the Grand Rapids area. You know, you've got a city where nearly a quarter of the people there are under the poverty level. You know, as someone who provides that direct care, that primary care, what's the answer for those people?
You know, direct primary care, we try to look, you know, at our pricing and whatnot. So if someone is under the poverty level, if they're on Medicaid, you know, we may not be the best solution for them. If they're having concerns, if they can't get in to see a doctor, if they're in the urgent care or ER every other week, you know, it may be worthwhile from a time perspective for someone to pay for the membership. Now, there are certain patients that we do kind of what we call a DPC scholarship for. If they're going through a hard time, if they sign up and a couple months in, they're saying, hey, I'm just having trouble, you know, affording the membership. It's not working out well for me. We can either try to work with them a little bit and try to increase the value of the membership or see what we can do moving forward. But, you know, DPC, essentially, we're healthcare. We're doing the best we can as from a healthcare perspective. But, you know, we are a business as well. So if mm-hmm. we, you know, have free care for half of our patients, then the clinic will close. That's kind of just the reality of it, unfortunately.
What would it take to get you to willingly go back to an insurance-based practice?
Oh, goodness. Nova would just have to not work out at all. Currently, we're doing fine, trying to make things work. But it would be, Nova would just absolutely have to be just completely blown up.
I gotcha. Dr. Matt Falkowitz, who's co-owner of the direct primary care office, Nova Direct Care in Grand Rapids. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
We turn now to Mary Ann Udall Phillips, who's director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Mary Ann, just how prevalent is this direct primary concept in Michigan?
Well, it's pretty small in Michigan. It's pretty small in the country. There's a service that actually keeps count of how many physicians participate in direct primary care. And nationwide, just a little more than 1,000 physicians say that they are direct primary care. Very, very small.
Would we say, what's the trend? Is it flat? Is it growing?
It's growing a little bit. Mm-hmm. We did a survey at our center that looked at how many physicians in Michigan say they are participating in direct primary care. And about 4% of primary care physicians say they are, but about 20%, a little more than 20% said they're thinking about it, they're interested in it. So I think it's a trend primary care physicians are watching.
So thinking of the traditional insurance-based medical practice that people are very familiar with, how much of a viable alternative is DPC?
Right. So people need to know that this is not insurance, right? This is a direct payment. That's kind of the word, direct primary care, direct payment between a consumer and a primary care physician. And in return, that primary care physician doesn't bill insurance for most services and basically says they will take care of the patient. They'll be available, you know, in some cases, 24 hours. They have smaller practices, so they do things directly with the patient.
Spending more time with the patient is one of the things we heard from Dr. Matt Falkowitz that he liked, that he wasn't on that tight timetable that they are under, in his view, when they're in the insurance model.
Yeah, so physicians who are doing direct primary care have much smaller caseloads, and they are not doing every 15 minutes a new patient. That's their focus.
So when you say it's not insurance, then what are the pitfalls for consumers there?
Well, there isn't consumer protection, and so people need to know that the insurance, the rules that govern insurance don't apply to these relationships. They're, you know, again, they're sort of direct between the patient and the physician. And the patient usually will still have to buy insurance because this only covers a limited set of primary care services, right? So, you know, if you need surgery or you need most medications, you would still need to either pay for that out of pocket or pay for insurance. So insurance would be on top of the kinds of services provided by your primary care physician.
So that's what you see as some of the drawbacks.
Yes.
What do you think are some of the pluses?
Well, the pluses are that you're not being rushed in and rushed out. Depending on the model, there are some models where you can get, you know, more enhanced services, executive physicals and things like that, depending on what you're paying for that. Sometimes physicians will say they're available to you 24 hours a day, so you have more access, you can get in immediately, so it's more accessible to the patient.
So who do you think this is not suited for? Who is DPC not suited for?
Well, certainly you have to have money in order to be able to do this. You know, they generally charge at least $50 a month for these kinds of services, and sometimes they're up to $200 or more, depending on the nature of the services. So people who don't have a lot of extra disposable income are not likely to be able to afford these kinds of services.
As you say that there are doctors in the survey who are thinking of this, who are,
yes,
open to this idea, what does this interest and this kind of uptick in DPC practices say to you?
Well, it says to me that many primary care physicians feel frustrated with the current structure that they're living under, that they feel pressed to see a lot of patients in a short period of time, that they don't feel like they can build those personal relationships that you might think back to the old days when primary care was seen as a very personal relationship. And so I think they like the concept. I do think they worry about, many of them worry about, the income inequality disparities that it might reinforce, because again, people are paying for this out of pocket. And I think there are many physicians who have concerns about that idea, but I think they'd like to get back to a day when they had a real relationship with patients.
And that concern you talk about, we hear that concierge care, boutique,
yes,
medicine, those,
yes,
terms are used. Is,
yes,
is there a work through around that, do you think?
For people in poverty or people who are very low income, is there a way to address this? There have been proposals. You know, the state of Michigan passed in 2015 a piece of legislation to test this idea within Medicaid that was designed to try to do something for people who are lower income. That pilot really hasn't gone anywhere because it's, again, it's more expensive for the state. It makes it very difficult. You know, we're balancing the cost of healthcare and trying to keep healthcare affordable with the desires to have more broader access to care. So it's a challenge. I haven't seen a very good workable model on that yet.
So what should patients consider when they are looking at the landscape and deciding which model of healthcare delivery is best for them?
Right. So, you know, they really should consider, what are their needs? You know, do they really need 24-hour access to a primary care physician? Is that something that's meaningful to them? You know, if you're generally healthy, maybe you don't need a model that's like this. If you really do want that immediate access and, you know, your time is limited and you have disposable income and you have a relationship with a physician who is in a model like this, you know, that might be something for you to consider. But you've got to balance it with all the other needs you have as a family, as an individual. Again, you're going to have to buy insurance in addition to this, and you're going to have to think about the fact that you're going to have, in some cases, double coverage, and this direct primary care won't have those consumer protections in it.
So where do you see, if you look out into the kind of the landscape of the future with healthcare delivery, where do you see direct primary care fitting in?
Oh, it's a really interesting question. You know, I think the whole question is a broader question. Where do we see primary care fitting in? One thing that we know in the U.S. versus other countries, we pay less for primary care, and we have fewer primary care physicians, and the demands on primary care are going up. As medicine gets more complex, as primary care physicians need to know more, and so I think we have to really be thinking about how do we support primary care physicians going forward. Direct primary care is one model. Some ideas around that have been surfaced, but there are other models that are being tested right now. So we have what's known as patient-centered medical homes that are where actually health plans, insurers give more money to primary care physicians to really do coordination of care. And I think those models have a lot of promise for the future. Accountable care organizations often put primary care physicians in a more central role and provide them with incentives and bonuses if they take on some extra responsibilities. So I think the whole question is, how do we better support primary care so we have viable numbers of primary care physicians for the future?
Marianne Udall-Phillips directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. It is always great talking with you. Thank you.
And you too, Cindy. All right, take care.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.